You're listening to Nick Espinoza here on the Deep Dive Radio Show on Huntley Community Radio, WHRULP, on 101.5 FM.
And finally, I want to actually talk about the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, and data breach reporting rules, because we've had essentially some major changes here that may have impact us as consumers about how organizations are reporting to us. Now, following a series of hacks and data leaks at major U.S. telecom companies, the Federal Communications Commission has proposed on January 12th a series of changes to its data breach notification requirements. FCC Chairwoman Jessica Rosenworcel, who published these proposed rules earlier on the 12th, said that the agency needed to update its existing reporting rules to, quote, fully reflect the evolving nature of data breaches and the real-time threat they pose to affected consumers, which often learn of data breaches way after they've occurred. And I just literally got through an entire list of data breaches here where you can see, oh yeah, they had this data breach back in like January, and it's a year later, now they're talking about us. You know, this is what we're talking about here. Now, in order to achieve this, the FCC believes that by eliminating a 7-business-day waiting period that is granted to telecom companies before notifying customers of a breach is a good start for this. Essentially, it's the first step in this entire process that they are going to roll out. The direct consequence of removing this current waiting period will be that telecom companies can notify customers of a breach as soon as it happens if they are in a capability of doing so and haven't been told basically by law enforcement agency to wait until an investigation has been completed. This also, though, presupposes, and I'll say this right now, that telecom companies want to tell you that they just got you data breached, because, you know, think about it this way. Now, if you're an AT&T mobile customer, and I'm not singling out AT&T, I'm just using them. Could be Verizon, could be anybody else. But let's say AT&T or T-Mobile or whoever has to come to you and say, hey, you just got data breached. If your contract's up, you might be like, you know what? I'm switching to your competitor. I'm moving to Verizon. I'm moving to T-Mobile. I'm moving to AT&T. You know, wherever you're going, because of this. So we are making the assumption here, or I should say the FCC is making the assumption here, that these companies want to tell you about data breaches, and data breaches oftentimes can be very damaging to organizations, although I think the best way through that is transparency. So I'm actually all for this. Now, in addition, the FCC wants telecoms to be required to notify customers of inadvertent data leaks as well, and not only situations where malicious and intentional acts were involved. This means that telecoms have to notify customers of a situation where they accidentally left personal data exposed online on unsecured servers, and that is obviously a big issue. We've seen that before. Verizon, I'm looking at you. They had 2 separate data breaches, I want to say a couple of years ago, of about $7 million or so each, when essentially their Amazon infrastructure was left unsecured and anybody could have gone and read those 14 or so million Verizon customers' information. Now, furthermore, the FCC wants telecommunication providers to notify its agency as well about any kind of breach, not just the FBI and the Secret Services. They are required to right now by compliance law. And I have thoughts on this one as well, just good and bad. I am all for the record, data breach notifications. I am all for that transparency. If my data is out there, I want to know as fast as I humanly can so that I can take the right steps to possibly protect myself. Maybe that's just ensuring I have credit monitoring in place. Maybe that means I have to change something. Whatever that is, maybe there's nothing I can do, but I would rather know than not. Here's the exception to that rule. And while this doesn't necessarily affect telecom, although it easily could, we have to understand that we have to run a balance between notifying the general public or the consumers that are impacted of a data breach versus the potential panic that a data breach can cause, depending on how critical the infrastructure is to national integrity. And the example of this is Colonial Pipeline. Now, think about it this way. Colonial Pipeline, when they were hit last year in 2021, the pipeline wasn't actually hit. The pipeline was fine. They hit, meaning the attackers hit the billing system. Colonial Pipeline could not figure out how to actually bill their upstream distributors and basically the corporations that were basically buying gas off the pipeline. And so instead of figuring it out with their insurance company later and keeping the gas flow, they shut the gas off. The media got wind of that. And then a national panic ensued. And so by virtue of that, you saw runs on gas stations. You saw fist fights at, you know, pumps as people were, you know, were jockeying for position to fill up their car before, you know, essentially the gas run out of the gas station. But here's the thing. studies essentially prove that if the public had no idea that the Colonial Pipeline was shut down for the 3 to 4 days that it was, there would have been no gas problems. There would have been no raised prices, no fights at the gas pumps, because the gas stations had more than enough gas to last 3 or 4 days through that. But because it was blasted everywhere, it's like, oh my God, you know, the Eastern Seaboard Pipeline, which, you know, does something like fulfill 45% of the entire U.S. population with gas is down, everybody freaked out, and then there were runs. And so there has to be a balance there. We can't simply come out and say, yeah, we have to shut the gas down. Oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, because that's essentially going to have a run. If it had not been reported until after, meaning, hey, a week ago, we had a data breach, we cleaned it up, all good, no problem, gas is still flowing, we would never have had as big of a problem as we did. It was a spectacular data breach either way, but because it caused a national panic, it obviously motivated the government to do things, which is a good thing. But the last thing you want, especially in a politically contentious time right now, is to throw fuel on the fire by looking at gas shortages. And as we are going now through supply chain woes and struggles, and I know some of you walk into your local supermarkets, and, you know, they're pretty barren. I was actually talking with a friend that lives in New York City, and he was mentioning that his local, I believe it was a Trader Joe's, was essentially out of everything because they simply couldn't be restocked. I feel a little lucky here being in the Midwest, being the breadbasket of the United States, that you know, we are probably going to be the last to feel this. But nevertheless, it's a huge problem. And on top of that, you start throwing on data breaches that say, yes, things like shipments are going to be delayed even more because the trucking company just got hit. That's a huge problem. So as the FCC creates these rules, I'm a fan of that, but I think we also have to balance and essentially quantify what the impact would be to the general population as we declare these data breaches. And if we have a possible situation that could cause another Colonial Pipeline level panic, then I think it's in the nation's best interest not to be notified of that until that breach is resolved. And I think that's the right way to do it. But this would also be essentially getting the media companies in line as well, meaning the news outlets, to essentially sit on those stories. And while I'm 100% for transparency, I believe that everything should be reported in full detail, just making sure we're obviously not compromising Colonial Pipeline's security even more by mentioning the products they're running or something along those lines, we have to run that balance. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on that. I think it's a super important one to talk about, because with all these supply chain hits that we're seeing right now, it's only going to get worse. And so with that, those were your breaches of the week. We're just going to say everybody's affected this time, but hopefully you are not.
You're listening to Nick Espinoza here on the Deep Dive Radio Show on Huntley Community Radio, WHRULP, on 101.5 FM. And now for the Deep Dive segment, where we take a closer and deeper look at a cybersecurity, cyber warfare, or technology issue around us. And if you have any suggestions for a Deep Dive segment or something you'd like me to dive into, you can once again find me on Facebook and Twitter at Nick AESP. Again, that's Nick AESP. Or you can send an email to questions@securityfanatics.com. That's questions@securityfanatics.com. I am more than happy to take a look at it. And if it meets our standards, we are more than happy to do a deep dive on it. So let's begin.
And this week's deep dive is actually kind of an important one, as it's evolving right now. And we are talking about the entire Russia-Ukraine situation, but there's more going on about this because we have some cyber issues as well, specifically on the cyber warfare front that I want to talk about, as well as some moves by Russia itself inside its own borders that, quite frankly, isn't making a lot of sense. And so I'm going to break all of this down. I'm actually going to give you a couple of different theories and possibilities of what's going on here. And I don't know if you've kept up with the Russian and Ukraine situation, but it has been just a very interesting and obviously concerning situation that has been evolving. And it seems like, especially the rhetoric coming out of the Ukraine government, which is essentially we are in the fight for our lives here, we're going to see what's happening. But this is what's going on. And a lot of news came to light, actually, around January 14th or so, give or take about 24 to 48 hours from January 14th. There has been a lot of movement, and it's starting to shape up in interesting ways. And so I want to examine some of those stories as we go through this. Now, here's basically the backdrop of this. If you didn't know, Russia has been amassing a military presence on the Ukraine border for weeks now, which essentially has heightened tensions in the region to the point where President Biden himself spoke directly to President Putin of Russia and issued a warning and spoke about the desire for de-escalation. If you didn't know, roughly 100,000 Russian troops, as well as all of their support infrastructure, meaning vehicles, planes, tanks, et cetera, are now on the border of Ukraine. And obviously that is a very concerning thing for the Ukrainians. So we'll see what's going on. And according to the New York Times, on December 30th, President Putin warned President Biden that any economic sanctions imposed on Russia, if Russia moves to take new military action against Ukraine, could result in a quote unquote complete rupture of relations between the two largest nuclear superpowers on the planet. That's essentially the backdrop of what is going on, which brings us up to the January 14th give or take news. And this is where I think this gets interesting and is starting to take some twists that really put it into my realm of cyber warfare, cybersecurity, and all of that, depending on what side of the fence you're on here. And so this is what's going on. Multiple reporting outlets on January 14th said essentially that the United States has information that indicates that Russia has pre-positioned a group of operatives to conduct a false flag operation in eastern Ukraine in an attempt to create a pretext for an invasion. Now, an official speaking to various outlets said that the United States has evidence that operatives are trained in urban warfare and in using explosives to carry out acts of sabotage against Russia's own proxy forces. Essentially, what we're talking about here is if you have a group, let's say, of special operatives or special Russian special forces that go ahead and make themselves look like Ukrainian anything and attack the bulk or attack part of Russia's amassed troops on the border, that essentially gives Russia the ability to say, well, we are under attack and therefore we must quell this and invade eastern Ukraine. Now, Pentagon Press Secretary John Kirby said that the Defense Department has credible information indicating that Russia has, quote, pre-positioned a group of operatives to execute an operation designed to look like an attack on them or Russian-speaking people in Ukraine, obviously to create a reason or a potential for this invasion. Now, on top of that, on and around January 14th, there is also more alarming news because on January 14th, Ukraine was hit by a major cyber attack that basically splashed warnings across major government websites in that country to, quote, be afraid and expect the worst. Now, this cyber attack unfolded hours after talks wrapped up with basically no breakthrough between Russia and Western allies of Ukraine, which basically fear that Moscow could launch a new military assault on Ukraine. And if you recall, Russia actually did invade Ukraine in 2014 and essentially seize and annex the Crimea region, which is has a very heavily Russian-attached population into it, but is part of Ukraine or was part of Ukraine at the time, now part of Russia. And so here we are. This is not unprecedented that the Russians may simply attack and the United States really didn't do much. If you recall, that was under the Obama administration. Now, according to the government in Kyiv, Ukraine President Zelensky has proposed a three-way meeting with the leaders of Russia and the United States, obviously, as well as himself. Zelensky's chief of staff, Andriy Yermak, said that this is essentially the life and death of Ukraine, hanging in the balance. Now, Russia denies plans to attack Ukraine, but says it could take unspecified military action unless its demands, which includes a promise by the NATO alliance never to admit Ukraine, are met. And if you recall, NATO is the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, but since the fall of the Soviet Union, has begun extending invitations to join NATO to countries that are not in the North Atlantic. Ukraine, obviously, being in southeastern Europe, has nowhere near the North Atlantic. But nevertheless, it hasn't stopped other countries in the region, former Soviet bloc countries as well, to join NATO. And obviously, that goes against essentially the buffers and the machinations that President Putin of Russia wants. Now, on top of this, though, we also have news out of Washington, D.C. on January 14th, and this is what's going on as well. Like I said, this is actually a rather complex situation. Senior Biden administration officials are warning that the United States could throw its weight behind a Ukrainian insurgency should President Putin invade Ukraine. So how does the United States, which, you know, we just exited two decades of war in Afghanistan, might pivot into funding and supporting an insurgency from essentially fighting one? And they're still working that out, meaning We just got done with Afghanistan. The withdrawal of Afghanistan, you know, by all accounts, did not go well. And that is putting it incredibly nicely. I don't care if you love or hate the president. That was not a good withdrawal, just given the logistics and the optics of that whole thing. And now we're basically saying that we would support if, you know, Russia invaded Ukraine and captured Ukraine, that we would support an armed insurgency there. And so they're still trying to hammer those out. But essentially, the Biden administration is indicating to the world, aka speaking to Russia, to say, hey, if you do this, we are getting involved. But even a conversation about how far the United States would go to subvert Russian arms in the event of an invasion has revived the specter of a new Cold War and suddenly made very real the prospects of the beginning of another so-called great power conflict. And think about it in this sense. I mean, if you're looking at it from the economic standpoint, Russia's economy is nowhere near a major player in the globe. But what they have is one of the premier intelligence apparatuses that was developed under the Soviet Union and continue to be honed as Russia became, you know, what Russia is today, essentially an oligarchy run by President Putin. And we're also not done here, because there was also some surprising news out of Moscow that was happening on January 14th as well. And this is where it gets really interesting. And a lot of things are definitely flying around in my mind. So I'm putting all of this out, and I think it's just a very interesting situation. But on January 14th as well, the Russian government arrested and charged several members of the ransomware crime group R-Evil or Reval at the request of the United States. Now, if you are a longtime listener to my radio show, you have heard me talk about Reval or R-Evil in the Breaches of the Week segment, because a lot of the most spectacular hits that we have seen that I've talked about, one of the big ones recently was the Kaseya hit in 2021. Was perpetrated by this group. Now, Russia's FSB intelligence bureau said that R-Evil has quote unquote ceased to exist, but there was no indication that any of the suspects would be extradited to the United States, which is what the United States requested. Officials said the investigation stemmed from an American request, with the arrest coming 2 months after federal officials in Washington offered a $10 million reward for information leading to the identification or location of R-Evil members. Now, the FSB worked with local Russian police to search 25 addresses across multiple cities, including Moscow, St. Petersburg, and others. And they also detained 14 people. They seized assets, including 426 million rubles, $600,000 U.S. in cash, as well as 500,000 euros in cash, not to mention computer equipment and at least 20 high-end luxury cars. And interestingly enough, if you know where to look on YouTube, you can actually see members of cyber criminal gangs in Moscow basically just tooling around in Lamborghinis, blocking down traffic, acting the fool, if you will, because Russia has historically turned a blind eye, giving them safe harbor to use Russian infrastructure to hit the world. And we'll talk about that in a minute here. Now, members of this ransomware group who have been arrested could face up to 7 years in prison under Russian law. And so part of the reasoning for the United States is because they've done such vast economic damage and criminal damage and reputation damage to corporations and government entities here in the United States, 7 years in a Russian prison. And from what I understand, nobody wants to go to Russian prison or prison here in the United States, but their sentences would be a lot harsher and much longer here in the United States as opposed to Russia. And that's even assuming that the Russians are actually going to convict them or try them. And hear me out here, because there are a couple of different theories here, because I believe that the R-Evil situation where they are arresting these people actually tie to the Russia-Ukraine invasion situation as well. Now, think about this in terms of one potential theory that we've got here. Russia has been feeling escalated tension for years now over their essential safe harbor of these criminal ransomware gangs. They've historically turned a blind eye because their intelligence wing, the FSB, and also the GRU, has typically used these kinds of gangs as cutouts to do intel gathering and hacking work for them. If you recall, about a decade ago or so, when Yahoo got hit and they had 3 billion mailboxes exposed, we eventually found out that it was a Russian national, a cyber criminal Russian national that was living in Canada that was being used as a cutout for intelligence, who had been paid to hit essentially 80 mailboxes, 80 Yahoo mailboxes that belong to senior U.S. government officials. And how do you hide the fact you're going after 80 targeted mailboxes of senior officials? You hack them all. And that's exactly what he did, and turned those over to Russian intelligence. Eventually, we caught up and extradited him from, I believe it was to Toronto, from Toronto to San Francisco, where he stood trial. So it seems to me that these arrests, assuming the Russian government will actually detain and prosecute them and not simply put them to work in some other way, is designed to placate the United States, as Russia's primary focus is Ukraine. Basically saying, well, there's so much pressure on Russia right now, over cyber criminals and all of that kind of stuff, but also there's new pressure because they are amassing troops on Ukraine's border and look like they are opposed to invade Ukraine, that Russia essentially threw them a bone. Here, we'll basically arrest the major criminal gang that we're talking about, and that will basically be a pressure valve and a way for the U.S. to essentially back off. And think about it. Think about it, because Russia basically has a history of ignoring this kind of thing. And now when they are amassing these troops for essentially an invasion while they're preemptively launching cyber attacks, they're now arresting these guys. I mean, this appears to be more of an attempt at sleight of hand de-escalation than actually taking this kind of thing seriously. And like I said, I think they're just using this so that the U.S. will ease up because, you know, we're getting something we wanted, and then Russia gears up to invade Ukraine, and here we are. Now, with that, I have an alternate theory as well. I actually have two more for you, because I think this could go many different ways. I'm not saying any one of these are right or wrong. I mean, I could be totally nailing it here, or Nick, I'm a complete idiot. We're going to find out. But here's an alternate theory. Russia has zero intention whatsoever of invading Ukraine and is instead using this military buildup as leverage in negotiations with the United States to ensure that Ukraine doesn't join NATO while they bide their time and attempt to destabilize the Ukraine government by throwing what they hope to be perceived as what is known as a dissident coup. Now, if you're not familiar with the different types of coups out there, there are things like military coups. That's when you see, the military of a country, tanks on the streets, essentially seizing the capital, and general whoever basically says, for stability's sake, we are going to run the government for X amount of time. That's a military coup. There's an auto coup or self coup as well, that essentially internal to the government, and its leadership decides to change the system of government. A dissident coup is basically something that essentially the January 6th riot or insurrection or whatever you want to call it was classified officially as a dissident coup, meaning there are dissidents that believe, that they have been disenfranchised and therefore will attempt to violently overthrow or detain the government to ensure that their person stays in there. So essentially, this could be a smokescreen for Russia to destabilize, through their intelligence services, through a massive misinformation and disinformation campaign, essentially destabilize Ukraine and then throw a dissident coup. In that case, arresting our evil is intended to be used as a smokescreen to give something the U.S., once again, something that the U.S. wants without giving an inch on Ukraine. And in terms of our evil, there's yet another alternative here that this could potentially be. The Russian government, as I've mentioned, likes to leverage the talents of our evil and other criminal gangs for their own purposes. Our evil has been in the news a lot for major cyber attacks, as I mentioned, Kaseya, for example, and Russia may want to take the heat off of one of their favorite assets, so they stage these arrests and then let them essentially reform as a new group and carry on. I'm not saying that'd be our evil 2.0, but they could just change their name, change up their game, and continue on, and then Russia gets to use one of their favorite, non-official assets to continue to hit targets they want to hit or gather information they want to gather. This ensures that they can keep using our evil, and our evil can keep making money as another entity. Now, if you recall, and if you are a regular follower of mine outside of my radio show, I do daily podcasts and videos and all that kind of stuff. And at the end of 2021, I had a 2022 predictions video / podcasts. And I mentioned that these groups would be laying low in 2022 due to international law and law enforcement scrutiny. And essentially, these arrests could give them excellent cover, meaning this is all a smokescreen. This was like pre-staged, meaning maybe the Russian government said, hey, all 15 members or 14 members of our evil, or pick the members you want. You guys have to be home at this time. We're going to seize all this stuff. You'll get it all back. You can set up somewhere else and we'll keep on rolling. But in the meantime, you're going to help us out by doing this. Now, either way, We're going to see what happens in Ukraine, but we're also going to see if members of our evil are actually in trouble, if they are not being extradited to another country where they will stand trial and not be given safe harbor. And in the United States, they, quite frankly, are hated very much because, again, they've done a ton of damage to this country. We're going to see what happens. We're going to see if they're actually in trouble. And I'm going to keep on that. And I'm going to let you know, probably in the news segment, as our evil unfolds. It's also why I did not mention in the news segment, because obviously this is in part the news. And so here we are. We've got a huge problem. Recently, as I'm sitting here talking to you on the air, as of Monday, January 17, an ex-former intelligence official in Ukraine basically said that, you know, this is essentially what Russia wants. Russia has no intention of invading, but essentially the Ukrainian government now has the ability to start heavily arming themselves. And if they've got some kind of dissident coup on their hands, there may be senior government officials that are very friendly with Russia that could start redirecting those arms to pro-Russian dissidents. And here we are. So we're going to see what happens. Obviously, if you're listening to this internationally and you are involved in the situation in Ukraine and all of that, please stay safe. Good luck to you. Obviously, the world is hoping we are not going to have another hot conflict and war and all of the death and destruction that brings. And hopefully, as we see these cyber attacks being launched from Russia against the Ukrainian government, that the Ukrainian government is actually able to inform their people, say, hey, it's not us. It's actually Russia. We have to stand together against these kinds of things. Misinformation and disinformation essentially kills free societies.
And thank you so much for tuning in this week. It was another fun show, and I think we covered a lot of really good stuff, and I hope you guys enjoyed it as much as I did. It was a really good time, and I hope you keep tuning in. Thank you very much for listening to the Deep Dive Radio Show here with Nick Espinoza. And if you have any comments, suggestions, questions, absolutely anything, once again, you can find me on Facebook and Twitter at Nick A. ESP. Again, that's Nick A. ESP. And you can always send an email to questions@securityfanatics.com. Don't be shy. I love the feedback. We've been having a great time with the show. And as always, stay safe and stay online, everyone. Thanks for listening.